This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for tuning in, WGN Radio. I'm John Williams. Pete Zimmerman is the producer. We start today with Farron Dawgs, the founder and CEO of Harrison Wallace Financial Group. Visit harrisonwallace.com. Farron, it's John Williams. Welcome back to WGN Radio.
Hey, John. Thanks again for having me. I appreciate it. How are you?
Good. My colleague Steve Alexander has been talking a little bit about that Suez Canal blockage. The mega tanker or container vessel has actually stopped the flow. Do you have some numbers or thoughts about what that means to trade and economies around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. It's creating quite a backlog in the potential supply chain for multiple countries and multiple products. I mean, even as of today, there's 238 ships that are waiting to go through the canal, compared to yesterday at about 185. And what it's doing is it's causing some concern with different tankers thinking they may have to go to a different route, an alternate route, and they're going down around Africa now, adding about 6,000 miles to their journey, which obviously adds incredible cost, not to mention delays. And the thing is we're not even sure, you know, this has a trickle-down effect here in the U.S., for example. If we buy a product from a European company, well, we don't know the origins of the raw materials that go into the manufacturing of that product. Are they stuck in the canal? What are those delays going to do to us? And what's going to happen is, I guess we'll have to see, but shipping costs are obviously increasing rapidly, and that all trickles down to us, the consumer. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. Hopefully they can get this situation remedied ASAP.
Number I saw was $10 billion a day goes through the canal in goods or the value of the trade. And I'm just wondering if that means either because the stuff I want is on one of these ships or the supplies to make what I want is on one of these ships. But will I be trying to buy a refrigerator or a microphone or something down the road and they'll say you've got to wait because of this?
Oh, quite easily. That could happen. You know, with the transparency of the supply chain is not necessarily very clear because we don't really know, is there something on a container that's stuck in the Suez that is involved in building that, you know, manufacturing that microphone or that refrigerator? What is my delay going to be? And we've already seen it with the pandemic, such delays as, for example, just in furnishings. People are waiting 20, 25 weeks just to get a couch. So can you imagine having a delay like that for a vital piece of medical equipment due to something in this situation? There are already about 35 to 40 day delays compared to what it was pre-pandemic in terms of getting these goods to, you know, from port to port.
Yeah. Is this a market mover in any way or maker? I mean, will this change some prices on the boards at all?
Well, I think it will, just because of obviously the increased demand. For example, in semiconductors already, we're seeing such massive shortages that, you know, it's the old supply-demand thing. And as that demand goes up and the supplies are short, it's bound to drive up prices, which will certainly potentially have an impact of revenue changes for specific companies.
I want to ask you about something that the Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said, not earlier this week, but I think it was actually today or yesterday. He told Morning Edition, as we make substantial further progress toward our goals, we'll gradually roll back the amount of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities that we've bought. And I only bring that line up because he used the word substantial progress, and everybody parses what the Fed Chair says. Do you read anything into that? What's the takeaway?
Well, I think the takeaway is that we're realizing that the vaccinations, the amount of vaccinations and the reopening of this economy and obviously the pent-up demand has accelerated the economy forward a little faster than what they had originally expected. And so that is getting more money into the markets, obviously, with the stimulus packages on top of that. It is driving the economy forward a little quicker than what they had predicted maybe 6-9 months ago. And I don't disagree with him. I think we do have to be cautious about just how much stimulus we continue to add to this market, because we have to be very cautious about what happens on the other side of that.
By that, you mean inflation or paying down this debt down the road?
Both, actually. I think the inflation is definitely a big component of it, as we were talking about just earlier with the supply chain. That has an effect of increasing prices. But then also, if you have, you know, more dollars chasing fewer products, that's going to cause potential inflation as well. So we have to be really cautious about that.
It's a pretty quick turnaround, though, right? I mean, we were just trying to get money out the door and save people's lives. And now, I won't say quickly, maybe the wrong word, but you get my point that now we're saying, okay, wait a minute, maybe it's too much. Do you think we've straddled that line appropriately?
I think we did the best with what we knew, you know, to do. Clearly, a year ago, this was all brand new to us, and we had no idea. We just knew we had to do something to help the economy as a whole, because there were certain sectors that were clearly, I hate to say benefactors of the situation, but, you know, the stay-at-home, work-at-home types of companies were obviously on fire, meaning they're, you know, they were doing really incredibly well, but yet the energy, financial sector, and you know, the leisure sector were really struggling. So we knew we had to get money into the system. Some of the packages that kept coming out were definitely beneficial. But I think, you know, this last package was maybe, in my opinion, maybe a bit too much. So we'll have to see, because from what I'm hearing and reading, you know, a lot of this stimulus money is going to people that, A, don't necessarily need it. And I was reading that a lot of this money is, you know, people are putting it in the market, which is good, but they're playing it a little bit like Vegas.
Meaning they're what, buying Bitcoin or?
Well, well, you know, we kind of go back to the whole the Reddit stocks, yeah, right? So right. A lot of people are jumping into those types of things. You do see some Bitcoin acquisition. They're probably taking more risk with their $1,400 stimulus check than what they normally would have if they just really needed to buy groceries and pay rent. And, you know, the design of this was not only to help the markets, but really to help the products and goods that these companies produce and, you know, kind of get the consumer back in the game.
Farron Doggs is the founder and CEO at the Harris Wallace Financial Group, harrisonwallace.com. Nice to talk to you, Farron. We'll visit again. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks. I appreciate it, John. Have a good day.
Ted Rossman joins us now, senior industry analyst at Bankrate.com. They have an interesting new survey that's out. I'm glad you could join us to talk about this. Ted, how are you today?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
You guys were looking into the impact of the pandemic, the remote learning, the economic shutdown on families. What did you guys find out?
Surprisingly positive information. This really shocked me, how parents of remote learners are generally feeling good about what this has meant for their finances, their kids' education, and the quality of their mental health. There were some groups, though, that felt worse than others. We found that parents of hybrid learners were not feeling as good as parents of fully remote students. We also found that women are feeling worse than men, and we found that parents of older kids are feeling worse than parents of younger kids.
Some of that surprises me, some of that doesn't. Let's start with the financial component. So you say that it was for some families better. How so financially?
This one really surprised me. 38% said that remote learning helped their finances. Only 18% said it was worse. Everybody else was about the same. In terms of the positive feelings, I have to think a lot of that was maybe the ability to cut back on childcare and extracurricular costs, although you could just as easily say that some families were spending more. It really depends on your kid's situation, maybe whether or not you were able to work from home or call in a favor from grandma or grandpa or somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about people spending more, a lot of times that was because of technology and furniture, the need to outfit the home classroom, if you will.
But what we're saying is this is the impact of remote learning on a family's finances, not the impact of losing your job or losing some of your income or the pandemic. I mean, the world changed. Now you're just isolating, did remote learning as a result of that help or hurt your finances? And for some people, it was an actual uptick. That I'm trying to decide in my mind if that means that family was financially better off or only that the fact that they were learning remotely made it better than it might have been. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, your point's well taken that it's hard to isolate that variable. You know, the fact is that because of stimulus, because of people spending less, ironically, a lot of households' finances are in better shape now than they were a year ago. Sadly, many are worse off as well. That's kind of the K-shaped recovery in a nutshell. I think specifically to remote learning, though, my feeling is that it's kind of been the best of a bad situation. I think even the people who say they like it, I'm not so sure they like it outside of the current coronavirus climate. I think they're just making it work. You know, for example, even in places like Florida that are very open, a third of parents are still declining to send their kids to in-person school. In Los Angeles, it's more like half and half. In New York City, 70% of their public school kids are still learning remotely, even though buildings are open. And I have to think a lot of that is fear of the virus. Although, you know, I have heard some stories of people who actually think that their kids are more focused and less distracted learning remotely. I guess to each their own. I see a remote learning future for colleges more than I see it for K-12.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And by the way, in Chicago, 25% of the Chicago public school students who could go to school go to school, but 75% of the Chicago public school students who could go to school do not. More like Los Angeles, say, than even Florida. You also broke it down by gender, didn't you? What is the difference between men and women relative to the impact of remote learning?
There was a big difference there. Women are much more negative on remote learning. It really stood out, for example, with their own mental health. 36% of women are negative, 32% are positive. The total flip for men, where it was 43% positive, 25% negative. We also found women feeling worse about their finances and worse about the effects on their kids' education, you know, relative to the numbers that men gave us. And I think a lot of this gets back to some broader themes we're seeing with women in the workforce. You know, a lot of women have had to either leave their jobs or cut back on their hours because of the pandemic. A lot of that, you know, it's a stereotype, but it's been borne out in research that, you know, women do the bulk of childcare, and that, you know, as a result of remote learning, a lot of women have cut back. There's even studies that show that when men and women both work from home, a lot of times it's the woman who's at the kitchen table, you know, kind of surrounded by the kids learning and the chaos of the day, and the man is upstairs in a private office. You know, I mean, it doesn't always have to be that way, and it probably shouldn't be that way, but these are just some of the gender roles that have developed in a lot of families, and it's very stressful for women and the effect on their careers and their mental health.
Well, if I had to guess which way that would break down, I would have guessed that way. I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm also not going to be shocked that women have had to bear the brunt of keeping the family going and working at the same time.
It's been very difficult, and it's stretched on for more than a year now. And even though getting kids back into school has been a priority over the past few months, as we've been saying, there's still a lot of kids learning from home, sometimes by choice, sometimes not. And I think it's relevant, too, that as much as the virus picture is improving overall and adults are now getting access to vaccines in much greater numbers, that's not the case for kids. A lot of experts are saying that especially elementary schoolers may have to wait until 2022. We're hoping that teens may have access to the vaccine by the fall, but it's definitely possible that a third school year could be impacted, at least the start of it, in August and September.
Ted Rossman is a senior industry analyst at Bankrate.com. Bankrate.com has this story and survey. One last thing. You talked about the mental health of the kids and the adults. Can you just break that down a little bit for us?
This has been a tough one. Our study focused more on the parents' mental health, and it was women 36% negative, 32% positive. Men, it was 43% positive, 25% negative. I've seen other studies that show that this is weighing on kids, especially teenagers. I think especially those middle, high school, even college kids. You just envision how social these kids are, and you know, they want to be playing sports and playing in the band and joining a theater group, and you know, they want to do all this stuff, and it's very hard to do it on a screen.
I was visiting with some mental health experts from Rosecrans, one of our sponsors. They deal with particularly teen addiction issues and alcohol problems and mental health, and sometimes those are there's an overlap there. But they said the idea that a teenager is a fully emotionally formed person is just not true. To say that they'd like to get out or want to get out or need to get out and interact with their friends when they're 15 or 14 or 16 is more than true. It's necessary. It's necessary for their continued development. And adults don't appreciate that because we're already fully formed that way. Your kids aren't. This is a critical time. So I think as parents make these decisions, I know they're keeping that in mind. But I guess it's a reminder to all of us not to just say, oh, suck it up, kid. You know, I had it rough when I was young, too. It's a very real thing for them and different than what adults are going through, Ted.
It's a very multifaceted issue. You know, usually at Bankrate, we talk about finances.
Yeah.
But I think here there's a lot of overlap between finances, education, mental health. I think this year has really been challenging in all of those respects and more. And I really do think that there's a lot of spillover between these issues. There's no easy answer. I think a lot of parents are going to continue to wrestle with this about, do we send our kids back to school? Do we not? Or, you know, even something like travel. Once the parents are vaccinated, but the kids aren't, what do you do about travel? What do you do about dining out? I suspect it's a very individual decision, and we don't totally know yet.
From Bankrate.com, Ted Rossman. Interesting conversation and writing. Thanks for your time today, Ted.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Let's talk to Jared Melman again. Hey, Jared, from Let Us Entertain You. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, John?
Executive partner at Let Us Entertain You Enterprises. You may recognize the website, leye.com. I'm just looking at some of your stuff here, Jared, and I know we're going to talk a little bit about Passover and Easter dining for folks, but let's just talk about the restaurant in general or the group. Are all of your properties open and running now?
Yeah, we're you know, open with limited capacity indoors, and we've been lucky with some good weather, so we've got a lot of patios up and running, too.
How's it been going, by the way? Has it, now that the weather's a little warmer and the capacity restrictions have eased a little, are people showing up? Are they making reservations? Are you as full as you can be?
You know, we are, you know, as full as we can be while staying, you know, socially distant. And it's actually been cool to see more and more people coming in saying, I finally got vaccinated and, you know, this is my first stop and this is my first time eating in a restaurant in over a year. So that part's been, I think, led to some cautious optimism on our end that we're, you know, excited to be welcoming people back that haven't been eating out regularly.
That's not exactly a rite of passage, but there does seem to be something almost ceremonial about this, right? It's like I'm reemerging and I'm going out, and I'll bet your staff has seen a lot of really happy moments for people like that.
Yeah, for sure. People just seeming relieved and yes, truly happy and excited to be in our dining rooms again.
And it's kind of brunch season, the spring, especially around Easter time. Are you gearing your menus that way?
Brunch has been one of those meal periods that's been pretty busy for us, you know, especially as the weather has gotten better and people are outside, you know. We're starting to bring back a lot of our, you know, favorite brunch offerings and doing bottomless mimosas at some of our places. And so it's been, it's been a fun time of the day, for sure.
Is it all dine-in, or are people picking up kits and taking it home like we were used to during the pandemic more so?
We're definitely seeing less of the meal kits to go and seeing more people on our patios and in our dining rooms, especially, you know, the dining rooms like RPM Seafood that have big patios and big open windows, but still absolutely doing a lot of to-go business as well.
Is there a restaurant or two of yours? How many are there? How many are in the group?
Oh, it's about 100.
Jared, you're supposed to know.
I'm sorry. I wish I had the exact number.
Here's why I ask. Are there one or two of them that you'd like to highlight that are either different over the course of the last year or are doing gangbusters or could use some help? Just shine a light for a minute on one or two of the properties that you think would be good for us to know about.
Sure. I mean, I'm most excited about one of our newest places, RPM Seafood. It's right there on the river, and it's certainly gotten a lot of great attention and has a big patio, so it definitely did well. over the summer, last summer, and as the weather is getting nicer, it's been fun to see it coming back to life. But it's an interesting case because it had opened up literally 2 weeks before we got shut down. So early on, it struggled because we didn't have a built-in carryout business. It wasn't known for to-go food. We were literally just getting open for dining in when we got shut down. So it's been fun to see that place coming back to life as the weather is getting better. And one of the places that I'm really proud of is our restaurant Sushi-san. You know, if you think about sushi, it's like one of those foods that's pretty hard to make at home. And sushi has been like a little shining star throughout this whole time. I mean, the creativity on that team and the talent on that team has been fun to watch.
RJ Grunts is up and running again?
Yeah, we're seating limited capacity inside. We're unfortunately not able to serve our famous salad bar, but we're definitely still open, serving Rich's favorite cheddar burger, and that place has a nice carryout business as well. So it's done pretty well throughout this time.
What have you done menu wise for Passover? How are you handling that?
You know, Wildfire has really led the charge. They've been doing Passover specials for years, but our RPM Steak is doing a brisket dinner, and there's all sorts of offerings for Passover and Easter.
Yeah. And then what do you all say for people that do want to order? Do I use a third-party delivery service? Do you care if I call in? Do I have to do it online? Does the whole LEYE enterprise do it the same way or differently? Just talk about that.
Do it a little bit differently, but a lot of our places have these holiday offerings available on Tock. That's, I think, probably the easiest and best way to book, but we absolutely, you can call in if you're used to doing it that way. And then, there's also delivery options like, DoorDash and Grubhub and Uber Eats. So, I mean, we are really on almost every platform, but like I said, Tock is probably the easiest. You can connect through that through our website. But yeah, it's all the offerings are listed on our main website, LEY.com, as you said.
Are the properties in the city and the core of the city struggling more than properties maybe in the suburbs or maybe in the northern neighborhoods of Chicago? Are people hesitant to come downtown, I guess, is what I'm asking?
I think we're, during the week, it's definitely been a little bit quieter than it normally would be. I mean, if I think about River North, it's such a great neighborhood because it has both people living there and hotels and offices. Well, during this whole time, obviously hotels and offices are not operating in any, anywhere near the normal capacity. So it's been interesting to say the least, but we're definitely seeing people still venturing down, especially on the weekends. So and as the weather's gotten better, I mean, I don't want to say it's felt back to normal, but it's felt more normal, especially on the beautiful weekend days.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm trying to remember now what our forecast is like for the weekend. I think it's going to be warmer on Saturday. No, let's see. Do you have the forecast in front of you?
It's supposed to storm tomorrow, but, I'm hoping they're wrong. It's going to be 60 and rainy. But then on Saturday, on Sunday and Monday, we've got some nice looking weather. It's going to be 50 on Sunday.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at, too. And then maybe 61 sunshine Monday, 63 sunshine Tuesday. So let's all embrace outdoor dining and dining out. Let us entertain you. It's nice to talk to you again. Jared Melman, thanks for joining us today.
I appreciate you having me.
From Let Us Entertain You, the executive partner over there. Okay, it's 12:44 on WGN. Let's go back into the WGN radio newsroom with more business news. This is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Caterpillar, the largest machinery producer in the U.S. and one of the biggest in the world, is facing shipment delays because of the container ship blocking the Suez Canal. CAT is anticipating a lag of a week or more in shipments from Asia to its facilities in Europe and elsewhere, and is even considering airlifting products if necessary. The company's already contending with delivery delays of up to 3 weeks as countries around the world reopen following pandemic shutdowns. Uber is getting into the prescription delivery business, and it's happening in Chicago. Uber is launching on-demand prescription delivery via its Uber Eats app. The company is partnering with prescription delivery service Nimble, which works with neighborhood pharmacies to fill orders. I'm Steve Gwithanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Agribiz, here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, the biz of gardening, John. It's going to be a nice weekend. As listening to the WGN forecast, looks pretty good. Time to get out in the yard, right? Remember the heavy, wet snow not that long ago that you were shoveling? Just before that, our gardening guru, Jim Fazell, encouraged us to get out there and knock the snow off of our bush and tree branches. Well, coulda, woulda, shoulda, didn't.
Well, unfortunately, it wasn't possible to do that in many cases. And these branches have been damaged. Some of them have just been pulled down. If they've been pulled down and they, particularly on evergreens where they're practically flat on the ground, make sure that nothing is holding them down. They'll eventually right themselves and be right where they're supposed to be. If branches are actually broken off, you can see where they're broken, really need to trim that dead stuff off. And that can be done practically any time, but this is a good time to do it. Cut back to where it looks like there's a live bud ready to grow. And the plant will start at that point and make new branches for you.
Do we need to apply that tar or paint or whatever it is on the cut?
The cut can be dressed, but you don't want to use tar. That has stuff that's actually toxic, and that just kills the bark. There are paints that are non-toxic to plant material. They're called tree paint, quite simply. Those will work. Actually, you do not really need to dress those. If you do a good job of cutting, cut them off cleanly, the tree will heal that over pretty quickly, maybe in one season or two seasons. And the only reason you're painting it is for cosmetic purposes. And it's healing very nicely, but it won't be annoying to you.
And longtime WGN contributor Jim Fazell. You know, I think he told me he's been on WGN nearly as long as Orion had been, about 60 years. Mr. Fizz will be back with us with gardening tips time to time as we warm up and get out there and get after it. Checking Chicago Board of Trade, beans are down about 8 cents, but corn is up about 6. Wheat is trading about 3.25 cents higher. At the Merck, we've got the pork party continuing. Pork and beef both are trading higher today. National Agriculture Week is winding up, and today is National Spinach Day. Yay. That's your money on 720 WGN.
You know, we're talking about people coming out, going into stores, going into restaurants. How about going and seeing some local hockey? And I'm not talking Blackhawks. Let's join Dan Lev, who joins us on WGN Radio from the Chicago Steel. Hey, Dan, you're on WGN Radio. How are you?
I'm doing well. Great to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you could join us. Tell us about the Chicago Steel hockey team.
Chicago Steel are a Tier 1 junior hockey team. The best 16 to 21 players in the world all come to one place, and they play in the United States Hockey League for a chance to earn a college scholarship and then go on and play in the professional ranks at the NHL level. There's over 200 USHL alumni that are currently playing in the National Hockey League under contract. So we are the best and brightest stars. And then from a fan experience standpoint, it's affordable family fun, very much akin to minor league baseball, where you're going to get a great experience on the ice or on the field when it comes to minor league baseball. But it's going to be an affordable family entertaining evening. So we're very excited to be able to host fans once again starting tonight.
They play at the Fox Valley Ice Arena in Geneva. And this is middle teenagers to, what, about 21, right?
These are 16 to 21 years of age. Most of them come to us already with a college scholarship, unlike baseball, basketball, football, where talent across the U.S. is spread out and there's a good chance of playing against top competition and getting scouted. The best talent in the United States and now in the world comes to the USHL with a Midwestern footprint. There are 16 teams in the league from as far east as Youngstown, Ohio, to as far west as Kearney, Nebraska. We're the only team in the state of Illinois, we've been having some incredible success here over the last few years.
Is it like the NHL? That is same rules, same time frame, checking, non-checking? Can you talk about that? What does it look like on the ice?
It looks like an NHL game. Incredibly fast, incredibly skilled. You know, 3 20-minute periods, 17-minute intermissions. There is fighting in our game. It is high skill, high speed. You'll be incredibly impressed if you're sitting up close as to how impressive these players are.
So if these kids are from around the country and world, do you do like host families then?
Exactly. They come and live with host families. If they're still in high school or of high school age, they'll either take online courses or go to brick and mortar schools. a good portion of our roster has already graduated high school. So usually they're taking online courses to be a step ahead when they step on campus, wherever they're going to play Division I hockey. Some of them may be taking a gap year before they step on campus.
So what's the fan experience like? Can I get popcorn? Are you doing limited seating? What's it like there in Geneva?
So safety and health are the top priority here as we get back to 25% capacity starting tonight. So temperature checks at the doors, masks are required, of course. We're seating everyone in socially distant pods. So when you purchase tickets, you'll do so in a group of really one, two, three, four, five, all the way up to six or seven people that you can purchase for a pod. So you're going to feel safe. Our building holds about 3,000 fans. We can get anywhere between 600 and 650 with that pod seating. It's going to be a limited concessions menu. Usually when you come to a Chicago Steel game, you get many of the same amenities that you've come to expect at other sports venues in Chicagoland. It'll be scaled back right now, but still a chance to see live entertainment. And as I said before, the key is to be able to do so safely. And we want our fans to come back when they're comfortable. And we've worked really hard over the last year and 19 days since we last hosted a game to create what our fans will see tonight.
How many games do you play at home this season?
We play 27 games at home. We have eight remaining. Our regular season runs until April 24th, and this year we are on the verge of clinching a playoff spot, so we could actually be the first team in the league to clinch one this weekend, and then if that happens, we'll go into May. It could run all the way up till just about Memorial Day if we were to make it all the way to the Clark Cup Finals.
Tickets are $10 or $15. Parking is free. This is in Geneva at the Fox Valley Ice Arena. You'll see guys there already have NHL contracts skating up and down the ice. Anything else I should know? Should I buy the tickets online in advance, or can I get them at the door?
Well, with the limited capacity, you'll definitely want to get them in advance at ChicagoSteelHockeyTeam.com. You can purchase them over the phone. You can get them at the door as well. But like we said, with the limited capacity.
Yeah.
And then tonight's a special night for us. Last year, we won the regular season title, the first time in the 20-year history of the Chicago Steel that we won the regular season championship. Of course, we didn't get a chance to play for the playoff title, the Clark Cup. But tonight we unveil our Anderson Cup banner for that regular season title. We were waiting for our fans to get back in the building to do so. Now that they're back, a chance to celebrate together. So we'll unveil that banner before tonight's game. And then Team USA comes to town tomorrow night. Some of the top prospects, again, in the U.S. that will be on display tomorrow night.
Good job, Dan. Good luck to you guys. And I'm really glad that you could join us today. I didn't know all about this. I think you'll see me out there soon.
Thank you, John. We're a hidden gem, and I really appreciate you having us on.
Dan Lev is the president of the Chicago Steel Hockey Team, ChicagoSteelHockeyTeam.com.